off. It is December
23rd.
22nd. 2014.
It's probably the 23rd, actually.
Okay, the last time we adjourned when a group of four farm workers had been set off by automobile to represent AWOC at the biennial convention of the AFL-CIO in Miami Beach, Florida. And they were going to try to lobby to get funding for AWOC restored after it had been cut off by George Meany, the head of the AFL-CIO. Okay. Now, it was a couple of weeks at least before those of us in the Stockton area heard the results, because all four of the delegates, well, there was an official delegate who had the right to vote in the convention. There was an alternate who voted only if the full delegate got sick or something. And then the other two were chaperones, because Maria Moreno was the full delegate and the alternate was a guy. And the convention in Strathmore, conference rather, not a real convention, the members of that conference said it wouldn't look fitting if an unmarried man and a woman were to travel across the country, unchaperoned in an automobile. So anyway, the four of them representing the farm workers were all from the Tulare County area. And it took a while for the word to get back to Stockton as to what had happened in Miami Beach. And when we did get word, we get varying reports. It was kind of like witnesses to an automobile accident in which it varies. And the more persons it passes through, the more the story can be changed. So according to one report that we got, Maria Moreno was given the privilege of the floor of the whole convention, and she made an impassioned speech which moved the whole convention to rise up in effect and demand of George Meany that he restore funding for AWOC. Another version was that, in fact, the most that she could get was a hearing at a caucus of the California delegates, and that she had moved them to do as much as they could, working with their friends in the other delegations. A third report was that, in fact, she hadn't gotten beyond speaking to individual delegates during breaks in the halls, and that they, in turn, would then talk to other individuals. And only by word of mouth did she have an effect, but that in the end, one way or the other, the convention did approve a resolution asking Meany to loosen the purse strings and to revive AWOC from its status in which it was operating solely on the basis of volunteers. I and one other guy were the only two staff members left. So then we waited another couple of weeks or so before we got word as to how this new funding was to be spent. And now it got to be really interesting.
Weren't there telephone reports? I mean, if you were the only two people in AWOC at that point.
I don't remember exactly why. Maybe. I can't tell you. Well, I had a friend from the garment workers who had been a delegate there, and she told me that there's no way that Maria Moreno could have been given the privilege of the floor, that was totally scripted and controlled by the iron fist of Meany himself, and nobody would have been able to deviate from the agenda. And as for the way in which the resolution calling for restoration was to be implemented, well, that the delay can be accounted for by the fact that there was going to be a total restructuring. And I'll just try to tick off some of the ways in which it was all going to be different. To begin with, at the top echelons of the total AFL-CIO, Meany was not willing to let the Department of Organizing continue to be in charge of AWOC, even though logically it should have been. But in practice, the head of the Department of Organizing was a guy named Jack Livingston. I think I may have mentioned him from time to time in the past of this series. He was a close personal friend of Norman Smith. Norman Smith had recruited him into the Auto Workers Union back in the 1930s. And Livingston had risen through the ranks to his present position, whereas Smith had kind of been lost in the backwaters. And Livingston had appointed Smith to head the AWOC only to reward him for their past friendship and to try to make it up for the fact that he, Livingston, had risen and Smith had. It was Smith's opportunity to have gone out in a blaze of glory, which unfortunately he didn't. But Meany could see that Livingston was not the man to head AWOC or to be in charge of the leadership of AWOC. So Meany set up what amounted to a board of overseers in California to be headed by the state head of the State Federation of Labor, a guy by the name of Thomas Pitts. had no background in agriculture, was a very conservative labor bureaucrat. And the other members of the Board of Overseers were also very solid and substantial old labor skates, as we used to say. Some would use the term pie cards, meaning that they were freeloaders. But in any event, they were not going to allow any more adventures of the type that Smith blundered into in the Imperial Valley, which led to tens of thousands of dollars in legal fees and resulted in absolutely no gains whatsoever. Smith himself was kept on as a kind of a, in a pensioned position. Technically, I mean nominally, he was called the assistant director. But the new director was a guy named Al Green, whose background principally was in the Plasterers Union, a building trades union, which, like all AFL unions, as distinguished from CIO unions, all the building trades unions were conservative. But more recently, Green's entire contributions to the labor movement were as head of what they called COPE, an acronym which stands for Committee on Political Education. And in actual practice, it meant not educating workers so much as rounding them up to vote in whatever way the leadership wanted, which usually meant voting Democratic. And at that time, we're now talking about January of 1962. And what was shaping up in California was a gubernatorial election. Pat Brown, the incumbent, was running for re-election, and it looked very much as though the leading candidate for the Republican nomination was going to be none other than Richard Nixon. Nixon had run for president against Kennedy in 1960, had lost, but he had not lost his appetite for political office, so he wanted to be governor. And he had a lot of friends in the Republican Party, and so it looked as though he were going to be the nominee. So, Green was appointed head of AWOC, not in order to do any organizing of agricultural workers, but in order to get out the vote for Pat Brown. At least this is what I figured out as I got to know him and observe his activities. Well, it didn't look as though he had anything particularly for me to do. So he wanted me to go around with him. As he was getting set up to regularize the vote the way that he wanted it to go, by the right kinds of equipment, He wanted modern office equipment to handle large-scale mailings, an addressograph machine is one thing I remember, a modern type of copying machine. The only thing that we had in AWOC was some very old-fashioned style of copier that used a heat process that I don't understand, but it was very out of date. Now, I didn't know anything about office machines, but it happens that at that time, I was seeing a woman, her name was Ellen, and you may possibly remember her, because she and I were very close friends, and she knew a lot about office machines. She had a job operating I can't remember the name of it. A rather sophisticated type of, better than a mimeograph machine. So, between the two of us, we went around with Al Green to places in San Francisco and whatnot. And we all were getting along quite well. And at just about that time, I guess by February, a house right across the street from the headquarters of AWOC became available for rent. And as it happens, it was the landlord was a major grower from the Stockton area. It wasn't being handled by a realtor, it was being handled directly by the owner, and I recognized his name. So when I told him I was interested in it, when he heard my name, I think he recognized my name also, and he knew that, he knew that I was with AWOC. Well, I thought that cooked my goose, and that he wouldn't want to rent to me. But an agribusinessman is above all a businessman. And he figured that I could be counted on to pay the rent. And so he rented this house to me. And it looked as though I was settling in. At least I didn't have to sign a long-term lease. Then, there came a time when it looked as though I could make myself useful as the, I guess I was still called the director of research. It seems that there was going to be a very important public hearing. It might even have been a series that went on for a couple or 3 days, chaired by a labor committee of the state legislature on the subject of agricultural labor. and the star witness from the liberal side was going to be the head of the State Federation of Labor, Tom Pitts. And Tom Pitts, as I have said, knew nothing about agricultural labor. And so I was asked to prepare his speech. Well, I had been preparing speeches for Norman Smith for a couple of years. So I did so. I knew a bit about how to avoid the use of long syllable words and high-blown metaphors and fine writing like that. I tried to make it as down-to-earth as possible. So I did that. And then it began to occur to some of us that all of the scheduled speakers were going to be people with job titles representing some organization or another, rather than individuals speaking only for themselves. And particularly absent were any farm workers speaking as farm workers with no affiliation one way or the other. So on our own, and now I guess I'm speaking of Ellen and myself, we began talking about lining up a few workers known to us personally as being reasonably articulate and able to break away for a day from whatever they might ordinarily be doing and willing to speak in public. And in fact, we did get three or four lined up. The hearings were to be held in April. And actually, there probably wasn't too much going on in the way of harvesting at that time of year. And so these people were very able and willing to take part. We weren't able to get them on the printed agenda. But when the great day came, at least the day in which it would have been most appropriate for these farm workers to have spoken for themselves, I had a tape recorder and I was going to be busy operating that. So Ellen took it upon herself to find a moment with the chairman of the day's activities and asked him if at the end of the prepared speeches it would be possible to add a few minutes for these workers to speak. And the guy said yes. So that is what happened. And it went fairly well, with the exception of my tape recorder, which misbehaved and began making a screeching noise at intervals that were so disconcerting that eventually I had to turn it off. But otherwise, I thought that the workers did very well, and Pitts stuck to my text a lot closer than Norman Smith ever had. So I thought that was somewhat of a success. And I guess 2 or 3 days went by. When I got a message to report to Norman Smith's office. Which was directly across the street. And I had no inkling of what it might be about. But when I got there, he was looking very, very serious. And in one corner of the room, sitting without saying anything, but looking very serious also, was Al Green. So Smith said, "Well, Hank, I hated this day, but I guess it had to come. We're going to have to let you go." I think that's pretty much verbatim what he said. So I guess I was silent for a moment or two or three. And then I guess I said something to the effect, "Any special reason?" And Smith said, "Well, for one thing, Pitts was absolutely furious that you let those workers steal his thunder. He thought he was to be the voice of California farm workers, period. And you brought in 3 or 4 others that he had not been asked about. Well, I could understand that. I didn't agree with it, of course, but I could understand it." Then Smith said, "There was also the problem that you can't control your friend Ellen. And I didn't pursue that, because I had a pretty damn good idea of what he meant. It all came down to the fact that she had, when she was much younger, I guess when she was in junior high school or possibly high school, joined an organization called the Young Pioneers. Oh my goodness. I've got a bullfrog in my throat. The Young Pioneers were, I guess, what is known as a fellow traveling organization. Of people under the age of 18 who were too young to be members of the older fellow traveling organizations, which were dominated by the Communist Party. I don't know what the Young Pioneers did, but I'm pretty sure they didn't sit around talking about overthrowing the government by force and violence. In fact, the older folks in fellow traveling organizations didn't sit around talking about that either. They talked about helping refugees from the Spanish Civil War and things like that. But as a result of a period in history called the McCarthy era, there was a senator from Wisconsin named Joseph McCarthy who created a panic in liberal circles by making accusations of communists being rampant in the State Department and in the U.S. Army and everything you could possibly think of, including that some that were absurd on the very face of it. But he succeeded in terrorizing a lot of left-wing groups, and a lot of them pulled in their sails, including the labor movement. And so the AFL kicked out a number of its unions on grounds of being infiltrated, or whatever might be the word. And even the CIO, although it was less inclined to be stampeded, if it found that one of its constituent unions did have a presence within its leadership of people who looked kindly upon the Soviet experiment, they also were expelled. The ILWU, for example, was for a time expelled. And the fact that my friend Ellen had at one time been a member of a group called the Young Pioneers League made her suspect, I guess for the rest of her life, and her friends suspect, including myself. So I can't recall, but I think I was given a very short period of time to get my stuff cleaned out. I do remember that I was given such a short period that I didn't have time to go through documents in the AWOC headquarters. To which I thought I had a right, including a lot of stuff that I had written, memos and whatnot. And so on the last night, Ellen and I spent the better part of the night copying everything that had my name on it from the master files of AWOC, using this archaic copying device. And the quality of the reproduction was very poor, and also the very nature of this heating process, I think, meant that most of it must have faded away and been totally unusable eventually. I haven't had a chance to go back through it all. And that would be one reason why I have never, I guess I haven't had the courage or the guts or whatever you might say to attempt something that I have always believed was needed, but no one has ever done. And I myself might have been able to do it, but I haven't done it. And that is a history of the AWOC, because it did play a role, for better or for worse, in the chain of events that eventually led to Chavez and his movement. There would not have been the Chavez movement, at least in the form that it eventually assumed, if it hadn't been for the survival of AWOC and the fact that those of us in the volunteer period kept it going when I think it probably would have disappeared entirely from view if we hadn't been there, and if we hadn't had that Strathmore conference and hadn't sent back the four workers to Miami Beach and all the rest of it. Well, we made a difference. I don't know exactly in what ways the whole history might have been different, but it would have been different. So, as I say, I have always regretted that the history of AWOC during those 2 or 3 years has never been attempted, and maybe it's not impossible even now if somebody were sufficiently interested and sufficiently young and vigorous, and I am neither. didn't know what I was going to do. After getting cashiered, I thought that I was entitled to unemployment insurance. I mean unemployment benefits, since AWOC had been paying into the insurance fund. And I knew enough about the system to know that if you're fired, you're not entitled to benefits. Unless you want to go to some kind of administrative judge and argue that you were unjustly fired. But Norman Smith liked me. He always showed that he did in various ways. He let me sleep on the floor of his apartment for months on end. He would frequently take me out to lunch with him. And so he allowed me to give as the reasons for my becoming unemployed that the organization was no longer able to afford the position of director of research. So then when I went to the unemployment office, they put me down as looking for another job as director of research for a labor union. And
probably not many of those.
Not bloody many of them. Therefore, if I wanted, I guess the maximum at that time was 6 months of benefits. If I had wanted to use them to the maximum, I guess I could have done so, because there were no other jobs of that sort. And in fact, I didn't look seriously. I had to go to a local union of one sort or another and ask or write a couple of letters. I didn't have to go beyond a certain radius. There were all kinds of regulations. But mostly I was willing to just lick my wounds for a while and maybe feel a little sorry for myself and a little angry and I don't really remember. Oh, well, I goofed off by making some home movies. I think if I were to look at the dates of some of those old movies that I made with you guys, I believe, for example, that we made the pie throwing movie during that period, and probably a few others.
Had you moved to Berkeley at that point, or did
you have... By this time, I had, of course, given up that rental right across the street from AWOC headquarters. Had moved back to an apartment on Kittredge in downtown Berkeley. One bedroom apartment. Where I was living with Ellen. That, in fact, that's where the pie throwing movie was made.
I remember that. You were painting a lot during that period too.
Yes, very good point. Because the the living room was
filled with paintings.
A mess. It was filled with paintings. And boxes and boxes and boxes. Yeah, yeah. Well,
so you moved there only after you were canned by AWOC?
I think so.
So there was a long period when you were visiting us once or twice a week, but you're still living in Stockton?
Well, now, that would have been difficult.
It's a long drive.
I thought that there had never been any substantial deviation from the every other weekend business, and early on I had settled into taking you to Sacramento.
Oh, okay. Just as sort of the default thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, there came a point at which I wanted to make myself socially useful again. And so I began to make inquiries about returning to the State Department of Public Health. Where I was still in good repute. When I left the State Department of Public Health in 1955, I guess it was, in order to go to the School of Public Health at the university, I was in good repute. In other words, I had not ever been fired from the State Department of Public Health. So, as I say, I began to make inquiries. I learned by the grapevine that the new director of the department, a man named Lester Breslow. I may possibly have mentioned his name before, but if not, I should, because he's a very important figure in my life. He had been a member of my advisory committee when I was doing the Bracero study for the School of Public Health. He was now the director of the State Department of Public Health. he was one of the few members of my advisory committee on that ill-starred research project, who liked what I was doing, although he didn't know. I don't think he was ever involved in the statement of opinion and conscience that got me into the trouble. Anyway, I heard by the grapevine that Dr. Breslow, as one of his innovations at the Department of Public Health, was he was looking for somebody to combine the fields of behavioral science and public health. He was looking for somebody competent in sociology or anthropology or social psychology. And the position called for a PhD. Which I didn't have, of course. But I guess I didn't speak to Dr. Breslow directly at that point. But I had another acquaintance in the hierarchy who was kind of his assistant. And I asked him, his name was Dr. Clark, on a temporary basis, would you consider me, because I have a graduate degree in sociology, if not a PhD, and I had actually a year or a year and a half of study toward a PhD, even though I didn't finish it. So how about taking on me as a temporary while you're looking for somebody to fill the job permanently? And I will end this day's memories by saying that I was given that temporary assignment. And in the next installment, I will talk about it. But for now, that's it.
Good night and good luck.
Yes.